Gentlemen. The first case this morning is Mallon v. Hospira. Mr. Wood.
It pleases the court. This case presents a unique situation in which different interpretations of a few key pieces of evidence dramatically change the outcome. Depending on how those pieces of evidence are interpreted, plaintiff Debbie Mallon was either denied a promotion because she requested FMLA leave within days of that request being issued, or alternatively, as the district court inappropriately found, she could not have been denied that promotion because she exercised her FMLA rights, because the decision to deny her the promotion came before her request. The district court's error here was invading the jury's province in interpreting those pieces of evidence for the jury at the summary judgment stage. It drew inferences in defendant's favor that are possible, but inappropriate at this stage and, frankly, unreasonable, given other pieces of evidence in the record. These key pieces of evidence show that Ms. Mallon has evidence of suspicious timing, other circumstantial evidence that supports her claims, including evidence of pretext, and that she can prevail on her retaliation claims. The first key piece of evidence that the district court misunderstood was a June 14th memo authored by a woman named Ms. Mansky. The memo contains notes of a meeting that predate Ms. Mallon's FMLA request. According to the court, based on one phrase in that document, Ms. Mallon had been ruled out of an opportunity for a promotion as of that date. But the text of that very document disputes what the court found. It says, across the top, there's no guarantee of any one position at this time.
The Mr. Wood, with regard to that email, was there any testimony from witnesses for the defense to the effect that that decision had been made by that time, interpreting that email or otherwise declaring that the decision had been made by that time?
No, Your Honor. The only testimony in the record about the decisions made at that meeting were that no final decisions had been made.
Is there somebody who had been absent from that meeting on vacation? Help me with that.
I believe Your Honor is referring to a human resources professional named Mrs. Bocek.
Bocek
said that there were, and she was not at the meeting, but she said that she knew upon returning from the meeting that no definitive decisions had been made.
Okay.
Two individuals who were at the meeting, Ms. Mansky, under oath, said that the notes reflected brainstorming and thinking at the time. Ms. Wallace, who was also at the meeting, another human resources professional for Hospira, testified that no final decisions had been made. It was an input session. At best, those notes reflect Hospira's concern that Ms. Mallon would be upset if she was denied a promotion to a grade 20 position. Key is that all of the other individuals doing jobs like hers, what was referred to, if I recall correctly, as a business analyst position, did become relationship managers for the groups that they were supporting, as well as received promotions to a grade 20 position. That would have been moving Ms. Mallon from a grade 18 position to a grade 20 position, which would have been promotion. So what that document shows is that Hospira knew Ms. Mallon wanted to be promoted, that she was in discussions, at least at some level, for a grade 20 position, and that the defendants knew that she would be unhappy if she did not get that.
Did the open box carry a grade with it?
Yes, Your Honor. The open box position eventually became a grade 20 or 21 position.
Yeah.
Sorry to interrupt.
Well, let me ask you while we're on this subject. You said this is pretty good indication from your perspective, at least, that Hospira knew she wanted to be promoted to the position. Did Anderson have any contact with that meeting or those discussions?
Both Mr. Anderson and Mr. Carlin were at that meeting.
And is it correct that Hospira's response to the EEOC said, in essence, that Mr. Anderson did not know that she wanted to be promoted to that position?
I believe
that's
that
not it, a direct quote.
I believe that is the import. I know the response to the EEOC said that
that she never expressed an interest in the position and never talked to Anderson.
I believe that is in the EEOC position statement. Mm-hmm. I know it inaccurately states that headcount had not been approved for the position.
That's a different issue, but yeah.
Which goes to the issue of pretext. But the document does show that they knew Ms. Malin was interested in a promotion because the same email also had a spreadsheet attached to it, and that spreadsheet shows that Ms. Malin was being considered for an RM of application, a relationship manager of application development. So she was, even after that meeting, still being considered for promotion to a grade 19 position. The key evidence that from that meeting that shows that the decision, as claimed by Hespira, was pretextual, is the fact that the open box position doesn't appear anywhere on the spreadsheet that is attached to the email. Mr. Carlin claims that he made a decision. I'm sorry, Mr. Anderson claims that he made a decision that the quality organization at Hespira was so important that it required two relationship managers. That decision must have been made at some point after this meeting, and thus presumably after Ms. Malin's FMLA request, because it is not reflected anywhere on the notes of the meeting. It's not reflected anywhere on the spreadsheet. So that is further evidence that helps support the idea that the decision to deny Ms. Malin's promotion came after her FMLA leave request.
Now, I'm hearing your focus on the FMLA claim. Are you still pursuing the Title VII claim?
Yes, Your Honor. We are still pursuing the Title VII claim. We do believe that that is part of what is at play. We do believe that the same evidence that shows that the decision was pretextual also shows that it was pretextual in the context of the Title VII claim. There is, of course, a longer period of time between her protected activity and the actual adverse act. But this is why...
Quite a bit longer.
On that issue, let me ask you, from the time that Ms. Malin made her complaint that she says Carlin tried to prevent her from making in 2003 until Carlin left the company in 2009, did Malin get any promotions?
No.
So she had four promotions before that time, 6 years of no promotions, several promotions since. Is that right? At least one.
She has had had no promotions during the time after she complained until Mr. Carlin left, and as a last act, and this is information that's outside of Your Honor's record because it postdates the summary judgment decision.
Don't worry about it then. Okay. Is it true that at least as of the time of the summary judgment motion, or decision by the district court, she was the only one of these characters who was still at the company? Carlin was gone. Anderson was gone.
No, Your Honor. At the time of the summary judgment decision, only Mr. Carlin was gone. Mr. Anderson was an employee up through the case pending, at least at the settlement conference stage in this court.
Can I go back to the 2003 complaint and the phone call where, if I understand Malin's testimony, she's sitting with Balig, her boss, while he's bypassing Shaw, in essence, to talk to Carlin, right? And she hears shouting, and then Balig tells her that was Carlin telling him to do as much as he could, anything he could to prevent her from filing, right?
That's correct, John.
Okay. In your papers, you've repeatedly described that complaint as a sexual harassment complaint. Would you agree that the plaintiff did not actually complain about the sexual content of Shaw's alleged harassment until her deposition in this case?
No, Your Honor. I would believe that she did not use the most egregious details. She conceded at her deposition that the most egregious details, but she was complaining of inappropriate actions by her boss.
Yeah, I get that.
Advances towards her.
Asking for co-signing a loan and some other kinds of requests to go out and so on.
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay. But she basically didn't provide the most egregious details at that point.
That's correct,
okay.
Your Honor.
But the district judge treated that as protected conduct under Title VII, right?
Yes.
And was there any dispute about that issue in the district court?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay. Could you also address the evidentiary issue that the defense has raised with respect to that testimony about, in particular, the hearsay issue about Malin's testimony about what Ballack told her?
Yes, Your Honor. Ballo repeating Mr. Carlin's comments to Malin is not hearsay under the definition of hearsay as set forth in Federal Rule of Evidence 801 D2A.
Well, the problem with 801 D2A is we've got two different companies, right? You might or might not be able to make a successorship argument. Why isn't it not admissible, as the district judge suggested, as a present sense impression, a statement describing or explaining an event made immediately after the declarant perceived it?
I assume Your Honor is referring to Federal Rule of Evidence 8031.
Yes.
And we do make that argument in our brief as well, Your Honor.
Yeah. Okay.
And Mr. Carlin's, I'm sorry.
Why are the individual defendants in this case?
Because of the individual liability that is available under the FMLA for acts of FMLA retaliation.
That's news to me.
I see that I'm in rebuttal time. This is not an issue that Your Honor's briefed, but I'm happy to. The parties have briefed. It wasn't in dispute.
Judge Hamilton wants to hear it.
No, it's okay.
I'm happy to provide supplemental briefing. But
No. It's not the focus. We've got enough issues to deal with this in this. But before you sit down, I'd like to raise a couple of other issues with you. With respect to the Anderson email of June 22, 2006, it's very short, could you summarize what inference you propose to draw from that email and why you think it's reasonable? I'll ask the defense the parallel questions.
The first necessary inference to be drawn from it is that it doesn't indicate what the status quo was at the time. He does not indicate whether or not, as of that time, he has made a decision to promote Ms. Malin or not made a decision to promote Ms. Malin. But the inference that we would have drawn is two inferences. Number one, that by its language, it's more concerned with what documentation is necessary than an actual decision-making process. And number two, that in light of Ms. Malin's FMLA request, Mr. Anderson was willing to reevaluate the structure of his organization.
Okay. And then one of the questions that comes up again and again here is how much Mr. Anderson knew in this period from the summer of 2006 until Manga is hired in 2007 about Ms. Malin's complaint about Mr. Shaw back in 2003. What's your best evidence about how much he knew?
Ms. Malin's testimony as to what she told him, which specifically includes that she was experiencing ongoing retaliation by Mr. Carlin because of complaints she had made about Mr. Shaw, that Mr. Carlin was holding her back and that she was not being compensated fairly.
Okay.
From that evidence, Hospira launched an investigation as though she had reported a claim of retaliation under its policies.
Thank you.
Mr. Kramer?
Good morning. May it please the Court, my name is Mike Kramer. I am here on behalf of all three defendants. Members of the Court, a typical FMLA retaliation case involves a situation where an employee takes FMLA leave, and soon after exercising the FMLA rights, the employee is terminated. In a typical FMLA retaliation case, you have evidence of retaliation, such as comments discouraging the leave, comparators with similar performance who did not take FMLA leave but got treated better, and or extremely close timing in connection usually with other evidence. Here, what you have is an employee who took FMLA leave while the company was doing a major reorganization of her department. She returns from her FMLA leave, and her job is essentially the same. Same pay grade, same level of responsibility. She's still reporting to the same person, Jay Anderson, and she cannot point to any comparators who were treated better than her. In a typical successful Title VII retaliation case, you have an employee who engages in protected activity, and soon after that, the employee is terminated or demoted. Here, in a typical Title VII retaliation case, you have evidence of things such as discriminatory comments, comparators with similar performance but who were treated differently, and or, again, extremely close timing. Here you have something completely different on both counts. You have an employee who complains of alleged sexual harassment in 2003, and then more than 4 years pass. At a different company, she's not promoted to that open box we've been referring to.
It's the same team, right?
Largely the same team, Your Honor.
And she receives no promotions in those 4 years. And she did check continuing violation, right, on her EEOC charge. You didn't note that in your statement, but it's true, correct?
I think that's correct, Your Honor. However, I think that the Supreme Court said in National Railroad Passenger that continuing violation doesn't apply to failure to promote cases.
Well, how do we deal with a problem like this? Because, you know, you're right. This is not a termination case. It's not a demotion case under either of those claims. But from the plaintiff's perspective, she's describing a situation in which she complains over the vociferous objection of Mr. Carlin, who remains her boss for the subsequent, her boss's boss for the next 6 years, and her career hits a ceiling. Now, maybe it's because she's maxed out her capabilities. Maybe it's because he's just decided to freeze her out. How do we decide that as a matter of law?
Well, a couple of things, Your Honor. One is, if you look at Ms. Malin's own submission to the EEOC, the one that she claims ought to be considered in addition to the charge itself, she notes that she was denied a promotion in 2003 prior to complaining about Satish Shah.
Everybody gets denied promotions now and then, right?
Of course.
Not just one, but you know, from her testimony, she's capped out until Carlin leaves the company. And her colleagues are coming to her saying, what's going on? And Mr. Shipps, for example, says, what is it with you and Shaw? You know, in the interim. I'm not saying all these things are still actionable with the 300-day limit, but you've got this course of evidence.
I don't think any of them are actionable, and I think that they're not evidence. They're speculation at best.
Speculation when somebody involved in making another promotion decision comes to her and says, what was it with you and Shaw 3 years ago or 2 years ago maybe?
I'm not certain of the testimony you're referring to, Your Honor.
Who said testimony that? About Mr. Shipps.
Mr. Shipp was not involved in any of the decisions at issue before the court here.
Not at all? Not any of them? Or just not the ones in 2006, 2007?
Not the ones in 2006, 2007.
Right.
And my understanding is the law is that the previous ones are not actionable, Your Honor.
Right. Well, I'm not disagreeing with you about that. But the course of events is evidence, right? Your whole hypothesis here is that 4 years is simply unreasonably long to assume that retaliation might still be going on, right?
That's not our whole premise, but it's certainly a piece of it, Your Honor.
It's a big piece of your argument.
Absolutely.
And what I'm suggesting is it might reasonably be, you could reasonably read this evidence another way to say that, in fact, Carlin had just decided, I'm not going to demote her, but she's not going anywhere further. And that's continuing in 2006, 2007, when, according to her evidence, Anderson is going to Carlin, I'll ask him about promoting you, and we never know a specific date when that doesn't happen.
Correct, Your Honor. I would point out the following. One is that the position that Anil Manga was hired into, the plaintiff herself admitted was a higher position. It's one that she said she was not more qualified than Manga for. She testified she had no evidence that anybody thought she was better qualified for Manga for that position.
Let's talk about her admission for a second there, because you made a big deal out of that. Citing what she had said, I think it was page 133 of her deposition, is that right? You're not asserting that you were better qualified for the position that Anil Manga holds than Anil Manga was. Is that correct? Answer, not for the position that they gave him, no. Right? That's what you're relying on.
Correct.
With all the negatives there, I don't even know what that means. Is that correct? No. But you did not mention in your statement of undisputed facts her testimony later with respect to the position that Anil Manga was hired into in 2007. Do you believe that you were better qualified for that position than Anil Manga? Answer, I do. Why do you believe you were better qualified? And then there's a fairly long answer, 280 of her deposition. Now, how is, I don't understand how in summary judgment practice you can present the first of those answers and ignore the second.
I think that the second one, Your Honor, was contrary to the first one, and I'm
sure. Of course it's contrary to the first one. So how is that undisputed?
I put it
in
the
nature. And how can you, I mean, frankly, this looks to me like you're trying to get the district judge lost in the factual underbrush.
Your Honor, with all due respect, our mission was to try and show the facts.
Undisputed facts. And this is one you've emphasized that is flatly contradicted later in the same deposition. And it's not at all unusual for witnesses to contradict themselves. Mr. Anderson, if I recall correctly, didn't recall a lot of things when he was being asked questions that he remembered later, right?
One could make that argument.
Yes.
I do
this
think
is summary judgment. So the plaintiff gets the benefit of the reasonable disagreements, right?
Reasonable inferences are to be drawn in the plaintiff's favor, certainly.
And conflicts in the evidence. You've practiced law for a long time. You've seen a lot of witnesses make a mistake in their first answer to a question, right? Particularly one as confusing as one that has got two or three negatives built into it.
Your Honor, she was asked the question more than once or questions similar more than once. And
but you don't get to pick the best answer. You're stuck with all of the answers, right?
Her first answer before any rehabilitation or off-the-record conferences, and it was a repeated one, Your Honor, was that she was not seeking the position that Anil Manga got and that she was not taking the position that she was better qualified than Mr. Manga for that position.
I guess you're suggesting a different summary judgment rule then, that the witnesses only gets the inferences that can be drawn from the first answer they give?
Your Honor, I'm not suggesting that.
Sounds like.
On this question, Mr. Kramer, of the 2006 restructuring, is there any testimony from anybody on your side to the effect that, yes, we decided not to promote her before this FMLA request was made?
I don't think there is testimony directly to that
effect. Isn't that kind of unusual, since you're asserting that's undisputed based on this spreadsheet and the email?
I think our assertion is that it is a piece of evidence to suggest that. And
it's
think
a piece of evidence, and the question has to do with the role, the way that summary judgment is handled. Because I looked at the district judge's treatment of that evidence, and I understand how you might read the evidence that way. But given, is it Mansky's testimony, and I think somebody else's, that no decisions, Bart Bocek, that no decisions had been made, and this ambiguous document, how do we decide that on summary judgment?
Your Honor, I think it's clear that the final decisions had not been made at the point that that Ms. Malin took her FMLA leave. I think.
Okay, I thought we were having a huge argument in your briefs about that point.
Your Honor, I think that the district court correctly pointed out that the only evidence they saw strongly suggested that the company anticipated she was not going to be promoted as part of the reorganization, and she, along with other employees, might be disappointed by that non-promotion.
That is certainly possible. That's right.
And my understanding was that is not what the district court was hanging its hat on, but was something of evidence.
What are the undisputed facts that you're hanging your hat on here?
Your Honor, the undisputed facts are that Ms. Malin complained in 2003 regarding Mr. Shaw, and I know I heard the questions that you asked to Mr. Wood, so I know that you're aware that she was not completely, she didn't include the most egregious allegations when she complained in 2003.
When did that come out about him sitting down and spreading his legs?
In her deposition, Your Honor.
How much later?
It was after she filed the lawsuit, Your Honor. Okay. So that was not anything that she. And I believe
her deposition was in 2010. Looks like.
Correct, Your Honor. Okay. So that was not anything that she shared. She, I think, admitted in her deposition she had not shared those types of details with anybody.
Do you agree that the complaint was protected conduct under Title VII, at least for purposes of summary judgment?
For purposes of summary judgment, we've not contested that, Your Honor. Okay. And then you have 4 years later for a position that at least a good chunk of her testimony is a position that she was not seeking and was not as well qualified as Mr. Manga for, with the caveat that we've already discussed, Your Honor.
Okay, so that's disputed.
She was not put into the position in 2007 when Mr. Manga was hired, and that's what she identified in her charge.
Okay.
So we do believe those
facts. She also said that was a continuing violation and that, in essence, for the since she came back from her FMLA leave in late 2006, she was doing that job. Anderson told her she was doing a good job, told her he was going to Carlin to get her promoted into that position, or at least talking to him about it, and she's not getting the title or the pay for it, right?
That is Ms. Malin's opinion.
Well, that's her testimony, right?
Sure, but Your Honor, I believe
she can. Are you saying she can't testify about what work she did?
Not at all, Your Honor.
Okay.
What work she did is factual. Okay. However, what she is essentially doing is testifying that, in her opinion, she was performing the functions of the open box.
Nobody else was, right?
That's true, Your Honor. Nobody else was.
Okay, and Anderson thought this was really important. He needed two people to take care of the quality department, right?
Aspirationally, he wanted to hire somebody into a higher position, yes. Mm-hmm. But fundamentally, she's not testifying, did the car hit the wall or not hit the wall? She's testifying, in my opinion, I was performing the functions that the company envisioned for this other position that nobody's in.
Who else was doing that job?
I don't think anybody was.
Okay, so they're essential functions for the company's work, and there's nobody but her doing them. And her boss says she's doing a great job, and according to her testimony, is going to his boss saying you ought to put her in.
A couple of analogies I can provide, Your Honor. One is the difference between an associate and a partner in a law firm. Right? The associate may say, hey, I'm doing all the functions of the partner. The partner's not even here. Partner's on vacation, or there's nobody in this particular position. That doesn't mean that it's up to her to decide what the functions of a partner are or that she's doing them. And I think that's squarely in super personnel department territory.
Sounds to me like a jury argument.
I think, Your Honor, that this court has repeatedly said that courts are not to sit as a super personnel
We've
department.
We've said that repeatedly. This isn't that kind of an issue. This is about what function she was carrying out. And then Manga's reviews of her also say she was doing that work of the relationship manager, right?
Manga's reviews after Manga was hired, doesn't have anything to do with the promotion, Your Honor.
Well, he obviously wasn't doing that work well before he was hired. So, back to the 2003 phone call with Carlin, why doesn't the present sense impression exception take care of the hearsay problem?
Your Honor, I believe that that phone call, Ms. Malin testified specifically she couldn't hear what was said.
It's about her testimony about what Balogh said, right?
About what Balogh said, yes.
Now, what Balogh said is an assertion offered for the truth of the matter, right? That it was Carlin and that he told me not to do all I could to prevent you from filing this complaint, right? So that's hearsay. But why isn't it a statement describing an event made immediately after the declarant perceived it under 803.1?
Your Honor, it may be, but I would submit that it doesn't create any genuine issue of material fact related.
Well, you're trying to say that you all are saying the whole foundation of this case is based on inadmissible evidence. You've argued that to us. You argued it to the district court. The district court said present sense impression takes care of that, probably. She didn't resolve the issue. But why doesn't that resolve the issue?
I think, Your Honor, that even in cases where there is some evidence to suggest perhaps there's a bias or even a retaliatory motive where there's a gap this long, I can't think of a case where there's a gap this long.
So this, we're not talking about admissibility anymore.
No, we're not.
We're back to the time and its continuing violation.
Correct, Your Honor.
Why did you describe the EEOC charge in your statement of undisputed facts as having checked only retaliation and had, without mentioning the continuing violation point she was making?
I don't have an answer for that, Your Honor.
Why not? Mm-hmm. This is summary judgment. You're supposed to be straight with the court about facts that are undisputed. You know, you pick the best answer from the witness and ignore the later conflicting ones. I mean, it's as if you don't think we're going to check the documents.
I don't have a response to that, Your Honor. We believe that
expect
we would
us to check
the
documents. Okay.
Pardon me.
Expect us to check the evidence.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Much time. We'll give it 2 more minutes in addition.
I don't think I will take it all. Mr. Carlin describes this case as, I'm sorry, Mr. Kramer describes this case as not being a typical retaliation case, but I think the discussion of the evidence with Your Honors shows that, in fact, it may very well be. The course of events that Ms. Malin described in her EEOC charge provides a bridge between her original protected activity regarding Mr. Shaw and the timely acts that were included in her charge. It also undermines any lack of inference based on temporal proximity, because it shows that throughout that entire period of time, she was, in fact, being retaliated against. As she reported to Mr. Anderson in January of 2006. Your Honor raised the question as to what would constitute an adverse act. Particularly recently, this court has been at the forefront of recognizing that Title VII's standards, FMLA standards, employment civil rights law standards need to bend to the realities of the workplace, and that the common law doctrine that has developed over the course of the 50 years since the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, need to maintain relevancy in a modern workplace in which, in a situation like this, an employee can go out on FMLA leave, watch everyone who's doing the same type of job she does get a promotion, come back and not receive one. That is a denial of an employment opportunity, both for purposes of the Title VII as well as for the FMLA.
With this open box thing, which came first, the reorganization and then the organization chart, or the organization chart and the reorganization?
The facts are not surprisingly disputed, but as a general matter, everyone agrees that the outside consultant's role was to determine the proper structure of the organization and the roles to be filled within that organization. And at the June 14th meeting, what was being discussed is who would go in those roles. On the spreadsheet attached to Ms. Mansky's email, there's no open box. So that decision, as it relates to that position, as we argue, was not something that was determined by the outside consultant. It was not part of this big picture organizational structure. It was a decision that was made, because it's not reflected on that spreadsheet, it was a decision that was made after that meeting and after Ms. Malin requested FMLA.
What level of the organization does that box report to?
That box reports to the open box reported directly to Mr. Anderson, who then reported to Mr. Carlin. Prior to Ms. Malin going out on leave, she reported directly to Mr. Anderson. So it creates a level in between the two.
Moved her down from, was it level 2 to 3 managers?
That's correct.
That
in the terminology
works, okay.
Used by the company, that's correct, Your Honor. Which matters for whose weekly meetings you attend, what staff meetings you're at, things like that. I see I'm out of time. I appreciate Your Honor's time.
Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.